there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and, well, whatever else comes up in your emails and your phone calls. I'll be giving out those numbers in just a few minutes, but before I do so, I want to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Starting out with some new friends, I'm going to paraphrase this email. It comes from Milan, who's writing from Pristina, Kosovo. How cool is that? I suspect this was put through an internet translator program, so I'm going to paraphrase. Hi, I'm Milan, writing to you from Kosovo. I'm 23 years old. My diagnosis is fracture of the talus. For my audience, that's the heel bone. I was injured when I was playing football on concrete background. And he goes on to say that he was doing active football competitively and only recreational. He went to the hospital, and the hospital put him in a cast, and I believe in traction. I love this phrase. They told me to gravely hibernate, repose, and intervene, and to keep the affected leg in possession of above the rating of the heart. Like I said, I'm paraphrasing the rest of this for you. After 3 weeks, he was let out of the hospital and went to a step-down unit, probably a rehab, where he was taken off traction and put on a variety of physical therapies, some of which are used in this country: interference current, magnetic therapy, cryotherapy, kinesiotherapy, and exercises. And after about 17 days of recovery, and we're getting close now to the requisite 6 weeks that a typical cap fracture is casted. So during that time, we had a really, really good recovery for our friend. And he has just a little pain now when he drives and can walk normally. So he works driving, and his first question is he able to drive a car without difficulty? I'm assuming that we're talking a stick shift here, and he doesn't say whether it was the right or left, but let's, for the sake of argument, say left heel, so he has to chomp down on that heavy clutch pedal. And if he can walk, he can probably drive, and so that's my first bit of advice to you, Milan. In terms of responding to your other questions, which is when can you play football again? And I wanted to comment, first of all, on the interesting difference in the approach to fracture management between Kosovo and here. 3 weeks in a hospital in traction would be just unheard of in this country. Here, hospitalization is so expensive that it's actually cheaper to operate on the bone and fix it surgically. Interesting difference in the cost of things. It makes you wonder about how costs are arrived at. We consider the blood clot risk for prolonged traction to be so important that generally operative care is preferred. A person might be put in a walking cast, and it would depend on the nature of a fracture. Let's take it to the 6 week mark, which is where we currently are for Milan. At this point, the bone is somewhere between 15 to 30% of its normal strength. That means it's capable of withstanding standard sorts of low level pressures. But when you run, you amplify that pressure a lot. So I would caution, Milan, that we're heading into winter now, and you have a new weather predictor. When the barometer pressure falls, that ankle's going to hurt. You'll have a weather predictor possibly for the rest of your life, but certainly for a year or two. It's okay to drive, and start your rehab with power walking, fast walking, for an hour. Then work up to running. Watch for pain flares. If you have persistent pain the next day after walking or running, you've done too much. You need to back off, rest until the pain is gone, and then resume at a lower level. Gradually work up to the point where you can run for an hour. I'm talking slow jog, good shoes, or a soft surface. Then do some sprints. If you can sprint and you're not having problems, then after about the 12-week mark, it would be okay to begin non-competitive play. The same precautions exist. If you have a lot of pain the next day after playing, in the bone, you've done too much, you need to back off until that goes away. If you're not able to get past that hump, you need to go back to the doctors and be checked for a non-union. Let's go to another couple of emails. This one from Jamie in Bonnie Doon. I'm Eastern European, I'm high cholesterol, it's genetic. I have been a vegan for 11 years and I'm 63. I have a low C-reactive protein and I was on Lipitor from 51 to 58 after my doctor informed me of my hypercholesterolemia. At 58, I switched to red yeast rice. I was always taking CoQ10. I had no adverse reactions, but about a year ago, when he was 62, I decided I didn't want to take the drug anymore. I'm active and spry, slim and energetic. Sounds like a personals ad. My questions are, should I take low-dose aspirin? Is there a rebound when one stops taking the aspirin? And what would be a good brand and dose to take? I'm well aware of the gastric ramifications of aspirin. As a child, last time I took it, it was always well-tolerated. Thanks for helping me set this straight up front. Pretty easy, Jamie. First of all, 81 milligrams of aspirin once a day is the standard dose that we would be suggesting. That dose will thin your blood just enough that if you have a plaque cholesterol accumulation in the coronary arteries and you have the misfortune for that plaque to crack and the little platelets start jumping on that crack, because when they see exposed collagen, it's football pileup time, well, you won't do it quite as quickly. And that means that you won't block the artery and you'll have chest pain and you'll have a chance to get to the emergency room and be given a clot busting drug and therefore avoid this horrible heart attack that is the rationale for all of this cholesterol mania that we have. Now, a little bit of aspirin goes a long way. And for most people, the 81 milligram dose is fine. There are certain circumstances where we might suggest a higher dose, such as diabetes or a procoagulation defect where people have a tendency to clot. And sometimes in post-stroke management, a higher dose will be used. But in your case, 81 milligrams taken with a meal should do the trick. It does need to be taken daily to get the full benefit. There is no rebound effect of going off aspirin. The platelets don't get stickier if you stop or forget. But it's just that the benefit in statistical group studies where they have people take every other day versus every day is lost. Whether that applies to a single individual is, of course, impossible to say, but we assume it might. I'm going to go to one more email, and this is Judy. She wanted to correct something Dr. Don said a bit ago. Yes, there is now a wonderful pre-existing condition insurance program, PCIP, as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Many organizations are trying to help the states get the word out. They want people to sign up. It is not a state budget issue. Our PCIP plan in California is paid 100% by the federal government until 2014. Okay, that's good to hear. I do want to point out that there was something very good in the news about this. And if you go to the AskDrDon.com website and go into resources, you will find a link to the California PCIP plan. But the big barrier for people, two good bits of good news, actually, one of which is they lowered the premiums. Woohoo! Enrollment wasn't even 10% of what they expected. They had visions of the floodgates, and the floodgates didn't happen because they made it so darn hard to qualify. So they said, well, since we're not having people beating down the door, maybe we'll lower the bar a little bit. So first of all, they lowered the premium cost, which is great. And secondly, and more importantly, you don't need to have a rejection letter on file 4 or 6 months ago in order to qualify. An affidavit from your doctor or any healthcare professional who has seen you will certify that you've had a pre-existing condition that would disqualify you for more than 6 months is going to be enough. So those of you with cancer diagnoses, even 10 or 20 years ago, who can't get coverage, those of you who've been denied because of pre-existing conditions of any sort, you can now get healthcare coverage. And for people who are, let's say, above 40 and have a pre-existing condition, this is a huge benefit. And just on the basis of this, I'm sorry, you know, Obama deserves your vote. Getting a little political there, but this was huge. This is the first time anybody has been able to budge this giant profit-oriented monolith that is the patchwork quilt of American healthcare. And he suffered a lot. He lost a lot of political capital, and now we're all mad at him for the jobs thing. We need to remember that health was the priority, and he made it the priority, and he followed through. Yeah, it's about as lame a law as you can get, but he actually got a lame law passed in this Congress. And I think we can all understand now, after watching this budget battle, how incredibly difficult that must have been. And we're going to our first caller, who is Larry in Atlanta. Hello, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I have to say, you've always given me fantastic conservative medical advice. Here's why I'm calling briefly. I just turned 63 years young about a week or so ago. I work at pretty much every day. 2 days a week, I try to go swimming at a local community pool. What I discovered while swimming is during my session, I have to go to the bathroom. I have to urinate about 4 or 6 times. And at the same time, I don't have this situation, you know, in any other instance. So I want to ask if there's something about swimming that cause me to urinate a lot more? And then two, should I also, you know, be drinking liquids to increase my electrolytes before or after I swim?
Okay, let me take question number two first, Larry. And the answer is no. You probably don't sweat very much when you swim. Because the sweating is a mechanism that our body uses to cool down. And if you're in water that's below your body temperature, you're already being cooled down. So that's not, for most people, an issue. But the phenomenon that you describe is universal among people with functional kidneys. And it's really an interesting mechanism. And it goes like this. When you're walking around on the planet in air, there's a certain amount of air pressure against your skin. And your kidneys basically are monitoring your blood pressure. They're keeping you in fluid balance. Now, when you go into water, the water pressure on your body is actually quite significant. It's multiple atmospheres of air pressure. And so as a result, your kidneys read as if you have too much water on board. And so they start making urine because they are under the impression that you are fluid overloaded. Then when you take yourself out of the water, you've lost some body volume, and so that's when you want to drink, is after, and you probably can just drink regular fluid. I have an article here talking about how sports drinks are mostly hooey, expensive sugar water, basically, with a dash of salt, not useful. So I'll throw that out as a medical opinion right there. Sorry, sports drinks manufacturers. But yeah, drinking free water for a person with normal kidneys is fine. Your kidneys are very capable of picking up extra salt from your next meal if you need it. And as long as you don't have a diet that is exclusively fast food and has no magnesium and potassium, you're probably not going to become trace mineral deficient from a habit of regular swimming. I would mention iodine. Just suggest, if you're swimming every day, you probably want to take extra iodine in your diet.
Iodine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's because you're breathing in a lot of chlorine. I mean, assuming it's a public pool, and people do pee in public pools, which is why we have chlorine in public pools. And the reason people pee is because it's too annoying to get out when you're doing laps and get out and go urinate in the bathroom six times in half an hour. I mean, let's face it, it's just not going to happen. So as a result, they need to keep that pool sterilized and keep the pH balanced. And, you know, I don't advocate drinking pool water, although I will remark that urine is sterile when it comes out, so you aren't going to get any bad bacterial infections. But nevertheless, it's just too gross a concept. Now, back to the iodine concept. When you breathe in chlorine, those chloride ions are actually capable of sitting on the iodine receptors in your thyroid, in your breast tissue, and the rest of your body tissue. And bromine will do the same thing. These are halogens, and they have the same valence, that is, the outer shell of electrons on the atom is the same as iodine. And so you will actually occupy your iodine receptors with the chloride. So it's better to take some extra iodine so those iodine receptors are full, and that way your body doesn't hold on to the chlorine.
The question on the iodine, first, the iodine is something I have never thought of in a million years. So I thank you so much for that. I guess my first question is there a safe way of taking the iodine? For example, maybe by taking a vitamin supplement.
Yeah.
Any ideas?
Oh, yeah. You can get iodine as a vitamin supplement. The amount of iodine to prevent a goiter is 150 micrograms.
150.
Yeah. The amount of iodine I suggest for people who are regularly exposed to this level of chlorine would be around 3 milligrams a day, and that's a conservative dose.
Okay.
However, you may need to work up to that dose because when you start taking it, you're going to kick a lot of chloride off of, or chlorine atoms, off of your receptors. They're probably already sitting there. So your body's going to have to deal with this stuff. So I would start with maybe 500 micrograms and work my way up. You can get iodine in dropper bottles, and one bottle will last you a year. A good brand is Iosol, I-O-S-O-L. That's the one I use in my practice. You can go online and buy that. Maybe you can find it at the health food store. People who have thyroid disease shouldn't use doses of iodine at the level I'm recommending without checking with their doctor. People without thyroid disease, it's no problem.
Okay. Can I ask you a fast question about aspirin?
You bet.
If a man, for example, you know, doesn't have any condition, quote unquote, is it still advisable to take an aspirin a day? You know, what do you think about that?
Yes. In fact, I think it was last week or the week before we covered this. And for people without any heart disease who are just 50 years and above, there is a significant anti-cancer benefit for about six different cancers. So not just cardiovascular, but I know it was gastrointestinal, and I believe it was prostate and a couple of other common cancers. The statistically decreased risk when people take aspirin. If you go back to last week's archives, I think you can find that story.
Okay. Dr. Dawn, thank you. Thank you so much again.
And thank you very much. And I'm always stoked when I get an out-of-state call. So thank you, Larry, in Atlanta.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I have a story here that I think deserves attention. And I want to put a shout out to Heather Bresch. Heather is 42 years old, and she's the president of Milan Incorporated, a generics giant manufacturer. She's also the daughter of a senator, which probably explains why she managed to make this work. We call this connections. But here's the problem. In the last, 20 years or so, there's been a massive switch in where the raw materials for drugs are manufactured. And this is particularly true of generics drugs, but it's also true of regular mainstream pharmaceuticals. 20 years ago, most of the raw materials were made in the United States and were subject to surveillance by the FDA. Now, they're not. So how good and how pure the generic drugs are in our market, and indeed some of the regular branded drugs, depends on how reliable, honest, and ethical those Indian and Chinese suppliers are. A few years ago, we had a major scandal. Some very callous people in China did a substitution on an ingredient that was used for heparin. Heparin is the drug we use to thin people's bloods to prevent blood clots. And the way that these raw materials were being assayed, they were checking the sulfur content. So the evil suppliers essentially put a different sulfur source in to fool the assay. So the pharmaceutical companies that manufactures all the heparin in the United States made a bunch of batches of bad heparin. As a result of that, there were 18 deaths and numerous people were sick. That got everyone scared. When Milan Pharmaceuticals bought in 2007 two foreign companies with plants on every continent for their generic drug sourcing, the CEO of this company learned that many of these plants had not been visited by an inspector in almost a decade. Quoting her, "As the mother of four children, I want to know the drugs I'm giving my children are safe. And as an American businesswoman, I want to keep jobs here, and that means making sure foreign drug plants have to meet the same standards as domestic ones. So, you know, we're not going to get any money out of the feds to increase the FDA budget. Are you kidding?" But she had a good idea. She said, "Why don't we tax the manufacturers?" And she, I would add, is one of the people with, as we say, skin in the game. She wrote a bill to tax herself. I am just so proud of this woman. This is a good corporate action. I don't hear these often enough, so I want to celebrate them when I see them. Maybe we'll get more. Maybe this will encourage good corporate action. Basically, what the agreement does is that the generic drug companies will be paying $299 million in annual fees collectively, and this will underwrite the FDA to go out and do inspections of the foreign manufacturing plants every 2 years, which is the same frequency required of domestic plants. Now, all I can say about that is please, please, please let there be in this legislation that these are pop quizzes, that the inspection is not announced 3 months in advance formally, that the inspector just kind of buys a tourist coach class ticket and shows up with his credentials at the door randomly at these companies. Because, you know, if you announce it 3 months in advance, places will have a chance to clean up their act, and I don't think that that's what we really want to see. So I have a caller, but I don't know who you are, and I'm going to go ahead and pick up the phone. Hello, whoever you are. Are you waiting to talk with me?
Yes, I am. Okay. My name is Henry Santa Cruz.
Hello.
And I'm 60 years old, and I've been dealing with some lower back pain for a few weeks, had some x-rays, and it turns out I have arthritis of the spine and slippage, is how my doctor put it, between L3, L4. His advice, well, you're going to be in pain, and you can take some Advil, Aleve, and that's it. And when it gets bad enough, you can get surgery.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, that's great advice. Instills confidence.
So where do I, you know,
okay.
Physiatrist, physical therapy. I mean, I've been active my whole life, and I don't want to be in pain for the rest of my life.
The words he used to describe it was slippage of L3 on L4?
Yeah, meaning the cushioning, the stuff between the L3 and L4 is disappearing.
Okay. So you have a copy of your MRI report or your CT scan?
It's it's neither one. It's actually just an X-ray.
Just an X-ray. Okay, so I'm not sure which of several possible conditions you have. Let me run through the possibilities. One of them is that you have a pars articularis deficit, which means there's a crack in the hinge between two of the vertebrae. Mm-hmm. And that means that on that side, at least, what's holding you together is ligaments and tendons and muscles and not bone.
Mm-hmm.
That's very common and often silent. Very, very frequently, the way you find that is someone comes in with back pain and you get an X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell whether it's fresh or not. If it's old, and that's the question to maybe go back to the radiologist and ask. If it looks old, you've had this forever. It mm-hmm. hasn't caused you pain. Now it is.
Yeah.
Now, did you do something that tweaked it? And now you've got pain in the area, but it has nothing to do with the slippage? Very possibly in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And now let's talk about what the other possibility is. I could interpret what you said as also meaning that you've lost some of the disc substance.
Yes.
And that you've got a narrowing of that space.
Right.
And how old are you again?
I'm 60.
Okay. So that's normal for 60.
Right.
And when I say normal, I mean average.
Mm-hmm.
And may or may not have anything to do with your pain. What we run into is the fallacy of someone's never had a spine X-ray. They come in with back pain. You do the spine X-ray. There's a change. You point to it and say, here's your pain. Where I would worry with an L3, L4 would be if I was getting thigh pain.
Which I am.
Okay. Inner or outer thigh?
Actually, outer and also to the knee and inside groin.
Knee and inside groin. So that fits with maybe an L3 lesion,
yeah.
Which means the nerve that's coming out is getting squeezed.
Uh-huh.
Is it positional, this pain? Can you move in and out of the pain in the thigh and groin?
No, it's pretty much always there.
And how long have you had it?
It's about 6 weeks.
About 6 weeks. Okay. Was there anything that provoked it?
I might have done something too much at the gym, to be perfectly honest.
All right. So where I would start would be, I would go with a chiropractor on something like this.
Okay.
And attempt a couple of manipulations. I generally give the chiropractor three strikes and you're out kind of thing. If I'm not seeing improvement, at least for 4 or 5 days after the manipulation, at that point, you know, forget it. Not just chiropractic. You also need core exercises, things to build up those core muscles.
Uh-huh.
But that has to be done pretty cautiously because
right. It's
quite possible that you've got some irritation, some inflammation of the tendons and muscles and maybe some muscle spasm as well as the pinch on the nerve.
Right.
So I would try antispasmodics, muscle relaxants in other words, and see if that makes a big difference. If it does,
then
what that tells me is that it's not so much the physical disc material that's pushing on the nerve, but the fact that the muscles are tight and you're squeezing the disc material. So, you know, this is fluid stuff. So if
uh-huh.
you can relax the muscles, the space opens up and it kind of sucks the disc material back in.
Now, the problem is I can't take the muscle relaxants because I take a Zoloft. And I guess they contraindicate each other.
Oh, please.
Well, that's what I was told
by
my internist.
I know, but, you know, I think it's possible to get a little bit too medical legal defensive on these.
Yeah.
There are multiple muscle relaxants. I'm sure you can find one that doesn't get metabolized by the same pathway as Zoloft.
Uh-huh.
It's going to require somebody to actually go look in the PDR rather than looking in the handouts that
right.
the manufacturers give you. Probably about 5 minutes of hard work will turn up a list. If you email me, I will send you a link to a website that lists the interactions in the cytochromes of all of these drugs.
Right.
And maybe you can come up by reviewing that with a list of candidate drugs that you can go back and say, well, how about giving me Soma or how about giving me Flexeril or whatever? You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know which drug is going to be the
sure.
one that doesn't get metabolized that way because
okay.
it's complicated as all get out. Plus, what we know about the drugs and how they're broken down doesn't necessarily equate to an individual because people can have mutations in these pathways and yada, yada, yada. And nowadays, you know, you can be sued for doing
sure.
for doing this, but you if there's any warning or black box caution, people just go, la, 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 hands off, I don't want to think.
So I shouldn't rush off and get back surgery.
Oh, God, no.
That would be the last thing I would want to do?
Well, the times to get back surgery are if you're losing control of your bladder or
right,
your bowels.
Bowel, yeah.
You know, that's an acute caudate equina syndrome. That one you got to get emergency surgery
right.
for. If you have muscle loss, if you're starting to see atrophy of the muscles,
uh-huh.
you've got a significant nerve lesion there. You know, never operate for pain is something I was taught in medical school.
Uh-huh.
And then I was reinforced by the orthopedic residency that I took.
Uh-huh.
So that continues to be my adage. I think that there are always exceptions to every rule. but operating for pain needs a level of justification that, you know, I'm not hearing here.
Okay. So chiropractic would be a way to go. Physical therapy?
Definitely. And that's what I mean when I say core exercises. You've got
the stomach,
Pilates. The deep muscles. Pilates is great if you have an instructor that knows what they're doing.
Okay.
Are you local?
Yes, I'm in Santa Cruz, Live Oak.
Okay. I would recommend, in fact, right down the street from you, North Bay Physical Therapy. They have
North Bay Physical Therapy?
Yeah, they have a trained Pilates instructor. Little small startup outfit. I always liked the little guy, you know, because I am a little guy. So, you know, that's solidarity.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you.
Bye. This was an interesting article. This is going on at our local major university, which is Stanford. And they are doing something really interesting, and they are validating it using functional MRI. Now, for those who haven't heard about functional MRI, we all know what an MRI is. Functional MRI doesn't look at structure, it looks at function. So you look at the glucose metabolism and the blood flow in the brain, and that's a pretty good indicator of what part of the brain is most active. These researchers have been treating social anxiety disorder, which, by the way, is a disease that was invented by a drug company and politically forced into the DSM-4 in order to sell drugs that were approved by the FDA for this indication. How cool is that? But coming back to this story, social anxiety is just painful shyness. People who are unable to get out there and interact because the voices in their head are telling them they're such an idiot and they're awful and they're stupid. And when someone looks at them, they project a lot of negative thoughts, and it's just too unpleasant to go out in public. So it's not agoraphobia, but it's similar. And when you look at the brains of people with this disorder, you see when they hear negative words, you see all sorts of lighting up in their brain, in the inhibitory parts of their brains and the emotional parts of their brain. The researchers are doing two types of therapy. One of them is mindfulness meditation, where you learn to focus on what's going on in your body and not amp it, but just notice it and move on and notice what else is going on in your body. And it serves to distract you, and it also lights up parts of the brain in the occipital cortex, which are calming, apparently. They have people engaging in another arm on this study doing cognitive behavioral therapy, where people are coached and they gradually confront their fear and expose themselves to challenging situation more and more and more. This is extremely interesting study because in the after functional MRIs, these levels of excess activity in the inhibitory parts of the brain are gone. And of course, the patients are saying, I feel much better, but so much for it being placebo effect or anything else. Let's go to our next caller. Hello, this is Tina in Santa Cruz. Hello.
Hello, yes, this is Tina.
What can I do for you?
I'm calling because a friend of mine has lost a lot of weight using something from pregnant women, human
chorionic gonadotropin, yes.
That's it. And I looked into it, and protocol is severe dieting for sure.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about this?
Well, if you take an appetite suppressant and eat 500 calories a day, you'll lose weight. That's true. Absolutely true. And it generates all of these huge testimonials online and all sorts of buzz. Same thing's true if you stop eating and you do a protein-sparing fast. You only consume 500 calories of protein a day. High-quality protein, that is, because in the 70s, a whole lot of people died from cardiac arrest from doing a low-quality protein. When you're eating only 500 calories a day, you can seriously screw up your electrolytes and your heart can stop beating. So I don't recommend this kind of dieting ever. Two reasons. One of which is that there have been circumstances where people kill themselves that way. Not so good. Secondly, when you diet at that rate and you lose weight that fast, all of the counter-regulatory hormones in your body kick in and start changing your metabolism to try to prevent the rapid weight loss. This is a survival mechanism that goes back to Neolithic times, or Paleolithic times for that matter. In fact, it's present in chimpanzees and apes and all the other hominids probably, although we can't look at the physiology for Lucy. But it's pretty no-brainer. You've got to be able to survive when there's no food and walk to get to the location where there is some food. And if you can't do that, well, then you don't get to have babies and your line dies out. So you've got centuries, millennia, tens of millennia, hundreds of millennia of evolution against your being able to maintain that weight loss after you stop eating 500 calories a day. And if you don't stop eating and you continue, then you'll dwindle away to nothing and die of starvation. So eventually you have to stop taking the HCG. And at that point, I am betting you that there is not a single person out there who a year after that kind of weight loss has maintained that weight loss. You can find me something, I will eat crow on the air, but I would want to see documentation. But seriously, I don't think it's physiologically possible to maintain the weight loss, so I think it's a bad idea. Unless you're trying to get down to your, you know, you want to fit in mom's wedding dress for your wedding, and then you don't mind if you balloon out afterwards.
Oh, okay.
That would be the only circumstance.
I get it. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day. And let's go now to Tony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tony, and welcome to the program.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine. Loud and clear.
Great. Okay, I have one question and sort of a follow-up to something else you said. They're both kind of quickies, maybe. One is I skinned my knuckle on my middle finger, and just because of just typical hand-washing and all, it's just having a real hard time healing. It's about a quarter-inch circle diameter, maybe a slightly less. And I'm wondering if, you know, you'd recommend something like Second Skin, one of the liquid, you know,
right, new skin, yeah, something
or
like
something
that.
That it's sort of a somewhat of an open wound, you know. I mean, there's a little red inside, and it was a good skinning of the knuckle.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that's kind of thin skin because it needs to be really stretchy, and you get down to the dermis fairly quickly. There's not a lot of epidermis. So let me ask you, skinning something, normally you see little red dots on a white background when it first happens, or you see just a sheet of red and not the little dots. So you were a sheet of red when it initially happened. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So you could use the epidermal things. I don't know how much of the time you have your hands in water. They slow down healing a little bit, but they also protect the area. And I'm not against their use, but I think I have a better solution for you. There is a material that's used to cover IV wound sites. It has various terms. Tegaderm is one brand name. It basically looks like saran wrap. It's sticky on one side. And you've probably seen people with an IV who have it on their skin. I use that when I have something on my hands because obviously as a doctor, I'm exposed to blood, body fluids, and even though I'm supposed to be gloving up, you know, I know that the surfaces are going to have material on them as well. And some of these viruses, like Hep B, can live on surfaces for a very long time. So I'm really careful about hand wounds because of the environment I work in. And this is a nice material. It does actually work like a second skin. It breathes. It's relatively flexible. And wrapping maybe an inch strip around your finger could work really well. You can pick that up. Well, most pharmacies will have it, but whether you can get them to help you find it in one of those big chain pharmacies, I don't know. You're local, so I would send you over to Horst Snyder's Pharmacy, which is not sponsoring the show. They're just on the corner there across from the Rio Theater, and they have really wide selection of these sorts of products. And I think you can pick up some Opsite or Tegaderm from them and wrap it around that wound and just cut strips of it and put it on. And after 2 or 3 days or when it comes off, you replace it. And that'll speed up the re-epithelialization. If you can't find that, a thick, thick layer of antibiotic cream, not with neomycin in it, and tape, just flexible tape, will work nicely.
Okay, yeah. It just seems like every time it gets a little wet in there, I have to start over again.
Precisely. So. And so what you're doing there is you're keeping the water from messing with the granulation tissue. Keep it protected. Okay. Let those little fibroblasts grow in. Unfortunately, it's kind of like trying to reseed a bare hillside in a hurricane-force wind, just in terms of the amount of physical stress that's coming across that knuckle. I mean, every time you reach into your pocket, right, you pull off everything that's been healed.
Yeah, I'm reminded I have to go left-handed to get in my keys.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you need some Opsiders on there, and I think that'll do the trick.
Okay. And then you mentioned earlier about electrolyte sport drinks.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, for those of us who do sweat a lot in the hot weather and exercising, do you recommend, I don't know, something like Emergency beforehand, that, you know, little packets with vitamin C and lots of other minerals, or just not even worry about replacing electrolytes ever?
I mean, basically what I recommend, I'm all about cost effectiveness, and also I don't want the sugar that they throw in there for taste. So how about a bouillon cube? How about chicken or beef bouillon? consommé. How about you drink a cup of hot bouillon after your exercise session? That'll more than replace your electrolytes. And, you know, it's one of those things that people have forgotten exists. Yeah, and you could do low-sodium V8. You know, that's at least got some nutrition in it and no sugar.
Sounds good.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And keep exercising. All right. We're going now to Christoph in Santa Cruz. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Dunn. I have a friend who had a drug addiction in her teens and is off drugs now, but now has a sugar addiction, and she's in her early 40s now.
In her early 40s now?
Yeah.
Okay. So, say again, she has a sugar addiction.
Right.
How does that manifest itself?
Well, she eats, you know, muffins, anything that has sugar in it, you know, she's craving for.
All right. And how committed is she to getting off of her sugar addiction?
That I cannot say really, but I think she is committed, you know, to at least start it.
All right. Well, let's then take the back away slowly approach. Generally with sugar addiction, you need a committed person, just like with tobacco addiction. They're about as powerful. You know, a boyfriend who wants you to lose weight does not equal a committed person.
Right.
So just kind of putting that out there. In terms of how you should approach it slowly, the first thing to do is to move towards not getting a high insulin when you eat your sugar. And one of the strategies for doing that is you reduce the volume of the sugar to about 150 calories per dose, which means you can't eat a whole muffin. You can eat a quarter of a muffin.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, you eat something with protein in it or fat. So some cheese with the muffin or mm-hmm. some peanuts. And what that does is it slows down the absorption of the sugar so you don't get as much of an insulin bump. There's also some things, there's some fiber content things that you can buy at health food stores. One of them has guar gum, G-U-A-R, in it. And those will bind the glucose and just slow down the absorption of the glucose. When you slow it down, you don't get as much of an insulin kick. Without the insulin kick, you don't get the rapid drop of blood sugar a couple of hours later. It's that rapid drop of blood sugar which fires off the hunger hormones, which causes you to crave more sugar 2 hours after you had your muffin.
Mm-hmm.
So what you try to do is break that cycle by adding protein and fat. Now, of course, if you add protein and fat to a person's diet without taking calories away somewhere else, you're going to end up with a person who gains weight.
Yeah.
So in the initial phases of that, you may see a 5-pound weight gain. But once you've gotten the person backing away from the sugar, then you keep increasing the lean protein content of their diet and try to get them eating for snacks protein instead of their sweet. So they get to pick their one sweet a day, preferably in the evening, not early in the day. Try for an all-protein breakfast, like scrambled eggs and cheese. And then as you get towards the evening, that's when you get your bread, your rice, and your sweets, because then you're going to go to sleep and you're not going to have this continued cycle of insulin rise, rapid decrease of blood sugar, hunger, eating, insulin rise, rapid decrease in blood sugar. So you break the cycle that way.
Yeah.
Like I said, it takes commitment, but that would be a strategy with a lot of coaching and a lot of support that would probably help. So switch the snacks to protein, all protein breakfast, and maybe the lunch meal. Make sure if you do have any grains then that they're whole grains.
Mm-hmm.
But commitment is key because you will have cravings. South Beach Diet, that's a good place to start.
What kind of diet?
It's a book called The South Beach Diet.
Yeah.
Another one is the Atkins Diet. That's a very, very high-fat diet, and it works. But again, if you're a sugar junkie, you're not going to like that diet. So I think the South Beach Diet is probably a better place to start if she wants to work a little harder at this. But again, there has to be commitment on the part of the individual.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's go to Katrina in Santa Cruz. Hello, Katrina. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm bipolar, and I have had a drinking problem since I was about 14 years old. I'm 38 now, and I've stopped drinking.
Good.
But I'm on Depakote, Seroquel, and Celexa, and I'm just very concerned about my liver and kidneys. I haven't had a recent blood panel to share with you, but I was just wondering if you could recommend some cleansing vitamins or herbs or something I could take.
Yes. Yes, I can. First of all, let me just put in a word for diet before we get into taking more pills. Because I think that's one of those things people forget, is that food comes with not just the nutrients that we can extract and know about, but all kinds of stuff that we haven't adequately identified, which are good for us. So I would really encourage you to read about the rainbow diet concept, which is where you eat something from each color group. So you eat something purple. This, by the way, is not artificial food color, but like natural purple, natural blue, natural red, natural orange and yellows. You know, that doesn't have to be fruit. Squash is yellow squash, right? That's your yellow for the day. Greens, of course. And each of these contain different bioflavonoids that help the liver. I'm going to refer you to a lecture, I believe, way back in the archives of Ask Dr. Don in the interviews. And you'll want to search for Dr. Jeffrey Bland, B-L-A-N-D. Dr. Bland and I did an interview on detoxification that lays out exactly the mechanisms of phase one and phase two detoxification. It lays it out in an understandable format. It helps you understand how to fuel your liver, particularly because that's what breaks down most of these drugs. But the Rainbow Diet Plan is a good start in terms of making that. And also reducing the amounts of additives, pesticides, obviously, but preservatives. I think we don't realize that preservatives are handled by the liver through the same mechanisms or channels that handle drugs. So when you're taking multiple drugs, you really want to stay away from other chemicals that your body has to process. So using preservative-free substances, that includes body and skincare products too, because those have to be detoxified if they're ingested. Spitting out your toothpaste, stuff like that. Just try to keep the burden of processing on the liver down. And sweating, actually, on a regular basis, gets rid of stuff without it having to go through the liver. So either regular exercise or using a sauna. Make sure you drink plenty of water before you go into the sauna. But saunas are really great for helping detoxify. So those are some simple physical things you can do before we get to the herbs. Now, in terms of herbs that help with detoxification, things in the liver, onion, and leek family are particularly beneficial because they contain sulfur. This also includes vegetables like broccoli, kale, cauliflower. Sulfur is sort of the general garbage man of the liver. Just about any compound can be detoxified through sulfonation. So when you run out of other ligands for detoxification, and when you listen to that lecture, you'll understand that detoxification happens in two phases. And the second phase, which is called conjugation, phase two, you need to have something that acts like a fishing weight that you hook onto the molecule to keep it in bile, keep it in the intestine, and let you poop it out. Sulfur is fabulous for doing this. So sulfur-containing foods are great, and become a garlic eater. Milk thistle is also really helpful for the liver. It's a general liver cleansing compound. So I really want to encourage you to think about getting maybe 300 milligrams of silymarin, which is the active ingredient in milk thistle, into your plan. And there are other detox component herbal things out there, which I think are very good, but I don't like to rely on extracted herbs. I really encourage whole food first, and then the herbs are kind of an afterthought.
Okay. That's great. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad that you're not drinking and that you're taking a healthy approach to your bipolar, and I want to really emphasize exercise. Exercise is really helpful for stabilizing those nerve circuits.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Jean in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jean, and welcome to the show.
I really appreciate your show. Whenever I'm home, I listen to it because I learn a lot.
Good.
So this morning, I was listening to you talk about the drugs from coming from overseas.
Yes.
And, of course, the tragedies that occur. I don't like taking drugs at all, but I have to. So here's my question. How can you tell if it comes from overseas?
And here's my answer. You can't.
You can't.
Doesn't that stink?
Yeah.
You have absolutely no way of knowing where the pharmaceutical company that produced your stuff sourced its product. That's not a requirement for them to disclose, at least so far as I know.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I think it's something that we should be rattling chains about in Washington, but I think they're a little preoccupied there, which is why I did that story about the drug companies themselves saying, you know, we'll step up to the plate and provide the funding because we know that the consumer, which is you, yeah, is going to put two and two together and say, you know, I don't really think I want to necessarily do that. And also for the supplement folks out there, I want to say that if anything, the situation for herbs and nutraceuticals is worse because there's no inspection except that which the company does. That being said, there are some very ethical companies out there that process everything. And there are independent agencies that go around and look at the processes, the manufacturing processes. And some of these companies that I buy from for my natural medicine practice, and these are products I put in my body, so I'm careful about this, they'll have three or four different independent agencies certifying them in terms of their practices. And I visited plants, like I went up to the Metagenics plant in Washington, and you get these bags, this room full of big burlap bags that get shipped from Israel, from China, and a lot of their components in their products, they might have 20 different components from 20 different countries.
Oh.
So when they get a product started, when they get a supplier, they vet the supplier by checking every single batch that they get, which is very expensive. But they do it. They run it through a gas chromatograph in order to be sure that it's pure. And then eventually what happens with the ethical companies is, having vetted a supplier, they then do spot checking. They don't continue to check every batch because they simply can't afford it. But they do spot check, and if they find an impurity, that supplier is kicked out and they find themselves another supplier.
Oh.
So I don't know if the pharmaceutical companies do that, and I don't know if the generic agencies do that. And I do know that many nutritional companies and nutraceutical products do not do that. So how do you find out? You go to the company's website, you look at their quality things, you go and look at their inspections. And the companies that do this are very proud of the fact that they're spending all this money.
Uh-huh.
You will be able to find that on their website. And that's about all we've got, are these independent agencies. Kind of like the Underwriters Laboratory. You know, when you used to buy an electrical appliance, if it wasn't UL certified, you kind of felt a little creeped out about plugging it into the wall.
Yeah.
Well, there are independent agencies that are acting in that role.
Oh.
There's one in Australia that, sorry, I don't remember the names of any of them offhand, but there is a whole structure for inspection and looking at keeping the consumer safe.
Oh, well, listen, here, somebody told me that if you check the barcode that and you learn to recognize it, it tells you whether it comes from overseas or the U.S., but of course, not knowing the code, I don't know whether it is or not.
It might tell you whether the final product comes from overseas or from the U.S., but it definitely doesn't tell you whether that U.S. company got all of the materials that went into it
right
from the United States. In fact, it's a good bet that 80 to 90% of the materials did come from overseas.
It's a catch-22 then, isn't it?
You need to do your homework, particularly when you're talking about substances that might be contaminated with lead or mercury.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, we have a big disconnect. There are a lot of greedy people out there, and it's not an ethnic slur, because 100 years ago, before we had the FDA, people were putting tainted beef in cans and selling it to the American public.
Oh, yeah.
There were huge scandals and a lot of bad press and a lot of muckraking at the beginning of the 20th century around this issue. We kind of cleaned up the act here in the United States by making it just too expensive. We jailed the executives. You know, when you jail the CEO,
it changes.
Big things happen. And it's like, there's a wonderful idea. I think I read the other day, this is not about medicine, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway because I love this idea. Make the CEO of any big corporation put $1 million in an escrow account that if the company loses money, they lose that $1 million.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not loses money long term, not short term. So, you know, after 5 years, if they make short term decisions that are, you know, great for the bottom line of the corporation short term, but in the long run result in damage or lawsuits or something like that, then they lose it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. It's kind of a goofy idea. But the idea is that the consequences have to accrue to the individual making the decision.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't get good decision making. We got to go. I'm sorry.
Okay, there's a phone number here. Will I get anything if I call this and ask them?
Yes, call the number. Tell them you want to see their inspections and you want to know their sourcing. See what you get. Let me know.
I will do that.
Bye-bye. We got to go. It's been a lovely hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. So long, and stay healthy.